all, I would like to thank very much the organizers for the invitation to speak, and also all the people that I've been so lucky to be able to collaborate with in recent years. So the plan of my talk will be first to give to make a little journey through some of the symmetry of the ADS-CFT S matrix in the fundamental representation, and then at the end to spend some time to describe the general S matrix for arbitrary bound state of the theory, and then conclude with some application and open problems. And apologies to all the papers that I haven't been able to include. So the focus of my talk will be on the S matrix that arises from ADS-CFT, whose excitations carry a representation of two copies of centrally extended PSU2/2 superalgebra. And since the S matrix encodes the information on the dynamics, it is very important to study its symmetries. And wherever available, it turns out to be very useful to express the action of symmetry generators on two-particle state, let's say incoming, through what is called the coproduct, which is a map from the algebra into a tensor product, such that it's an homomorphism, and then to define another map, which you could think of as the action on outgoing two-particle state, which is the opposite coproduct delta op, which is obtained by from delta by applying the permutation. So this is a natural language. To start with, let me reproduce here this centrally extended PSU2/2 Lie superalgebras. Here are the commutation relations. L and R are bosonic generators. Q and G supercharges. C, C dagger, and H are central charges. And the action of the symmetry on the spin chain is dynamic. It means that the generators, when they act on excitations, also destroy or create sites, this Z minus and Z plus. This automatically implies that the action on two-particle state is non-local. And here I've reproduced an intuitive way how one could see it. Let me act with one of the central charges on the first of these excited states. Then, since it's also destroying one of the sites in the middle, I have to rescale a little bit the variables in between. And rescaling this, I pick up also a factor which depends on the momentum of the second excitation. So you immediately see that you are acting on the first, but you also pick up something that pertains to the second particle. And if you read off the coproduct from this relation, you immediately see that this is the form. So it gets a factor here, e to the ip, which makes it non-trivial. Now, you can do, of course, the same not only for these central charges, but for an arbitrary generator in this algebra. And actually, it turns out that the coproduct is controlled by this quantum number, Q, which appears in this exponent. And then, whenever you have a central element in the OPF algebra, and you have an R matrix, you have to ensure that the coproduct is symmetric on the center. It's very easy to see, because the center commutes with the R matrix itself. So we have a constraint that the delta op, the opposite coproduct on the center, must be equal to delta. You could say that the coproduct is co-commutative. And in our case, this is guaranteed by this physicality requirement. So this e to the ip that appeared in the coproduct is related to the central charges. And it's straightforward to prove that this makes the coproduct on the central charge co-commutative. So everything is fine, and one can check that all the axioms of OPF algebras are satisfied, including the antipode, that's another map that makes it an OPF algebra. Now, let me give you a worksheet picture. We had the spin chain one. What happens on the worksheet? This gentleman made a very thorough procedure, inspired by Bernard and Leclerc procedure, to show that actually on the worksheet, this coproduct emerges. But let me give you a quick argument, semi-classical one. From this paper, we know that in the Lightcon worksheet theory, the supercharges have a bit of non-locality, which is this e to the I integral from minus infinity to sigma of some field. And now, let me imagine that classically, on the worksheet, there are two well-separated solitonic excitations that simulate my scattering state, classically. How do I compute the charge, the action on two particle states of this charge? Well, I just close my eyes, and I assume that I just need to compute the expression of the charge on the profile. And you see that if I do this, I have to treat this non-local piece with a little care. I have to split it first from minus infinity to zero, then from zero to infinity, because this is what is felt by one or the other solitons. And when I do this, I pick up a factor here that goes out of the integral and pertains to the first excitation, because it's from minus infinity to zero. So I pick up this, which produces this coproduct. So, quick rule of thumb, just from the classical expression of the charge, which has a non-locality, of course I get a non-local coproduct. So, okay, let me skip crossing symmetry, which is of course important, and Fadeyev's homological, because I want to focus mainly on Youngians. So what is a Youngian for the purpose of this talk? We have seen that there is a Lie superalgebra of symmetries underlying this S matrix. Suppose that we have additional charges, Q hat, which satisfy this relation, plus some set of relations. So I just generate an algebra by commuting these charges subject to some conditions. And this is the coproduct, the action in two-particle state, of Q and Q hat, as given by Drinkfeld. Of course, Youngians have a long story on the spin chain and in the classical string theory, but for the purpose of this talk, which will focus on the S matrix, very relevant was the discovery of Bizert of a Youngian symmetry of the S matrix in the fundamental representation. We know that the Lie superalgebra generators have this kind of coproduct, which is a little bit modified with respect to the one that you normally have, which is the trivial one. So you expect also a modification, as Bizert found, for the Youngian generators. They also appear with some factor. But apart from that, it's very similar to the standard one. Apart from some comments, first comment is that these generators come in what is called the evaluation representation. So the Q hat are just multiplied by a spectral parameter times the Lie algebra generators, and this is the expression of the spectral parameter in terms of the labels of the representation, this x plus, x minus. It's easy to check that you satisfy the commutation relation indeed. And also, even though there are some problems because, as we have heard, the killing form of this algebra is zero, you cannot invert what you would need to properly define this structure constant. Nevertheless, you can give the complete table of coproducts. It can be fully determined. And here are some proposals for a deeper understanding of this. Then, of course, we've seen that the coproduct is non-local. And traditionally, what we are told is that when you have a Youngian symmetry for an S matrix, and you have an evaluation representation, you expect it to depend on the difference, because the Youngian is invariant under a shift automorphism. But we know, on the other hand, that the S matrix that Bizert found is not. It doesn't possess this, this difference form. But, okay, this is very clear, but let's just keep in mind this fact for later purposes. And then let me remark that in higher representation for higher bound set, and I will come back to this, one has to use either the Young-Baxter equation or the Youngian symmetry itself to completely fix the S matrix, while in the fundamental it was fixed just by the Lie algebra. Do we have a continuum picture? Okay, this is borrowed from standard treatments. So what do we expect? Again, let's go on a hypothetical worksheet, and let me just take this example. Suppose you have such Lie algebra valued currents and conserved charges that satisfy this well-known condition of flatness, then we know that there are no local charges. This were studied long ago. They're very well-known. And now, okay, let me just give you a prototype of this where you can check everything, and this is this principal chiral model. So you can construct the neuter currents and verify that they are flat, and you have such no local charges. Immediately, once you have this no local charges, let's go back to our two solitons. Again, I want to repeat the same semi-classical argument. What's the action of such a non-local charge on two-particle state? Roughly, semi-classically, I evaluate this on the profile. Now it's a little longer because I have a nastier integral, as you see. So I have to be careful. I have to split this, which is a local piece, into minus infinity, 0, 0 infinity, and I have to split this into three pieces. And you see that I reconstruct on one hand the Q that would pertain to the faraway soliton in this side. On the other hand, I reconstruct what I would get on this other side. But due to this nested integral, I also get a mixed term, which exactly produces this non-local part in the coproduct. So again, a quick way to see how this coproduct arises from the explicit worksheet, let's call them, expression for the charges. And then the standard story went that if you're able to quantize this action, then you have an Hopf algebra realization on the Hilbert space of states, where these two solitons hypothetically live in the quantum theory. So something similar should happen for the string worksheet because such a construction is available. So that's something to keep in mind. Okay, I did this. Yes. So, again, some expected consequence of having Youngian symmetry. We have already seen some. The Youngian is an infinite dimensional non-abelian symmetry algebra, and this should constrain the S matrix very much. Also, the spectrum should naturally organize in a reducible representation on the Youngian. In other words, you expect this to be a spectrum-generating algebra, since it's supposed to commute with the Hamiltonian, very much like angular momentum. Then some consequence that you expect on the transfer matrix. But for this talk, this would be the nice thing. You expect that the whole machinery of Youngian doubles and rational R matrices, Hopf algebras and quantum groups that mathematicians developed in great detail, and here you can have some review, for example, would enter the game. That's the expectation. Let me skip Kirillov Rashitikin. So, in particular, there is one algebraic object which we would very much like to have, which is the universal R matrix. The universal R matrix is the answer to the following question. Can we find an abstract element that lives in the tensor product of the algebra, of the Hopf algebra, with itself, that satisfies this fundamental invariance that we saw at the beginning, abstractly, which means independently on the representation that I choose? Just, can I write this R in terms purely of symmetry generators? From a physical point of view, you could say, since we know that there is so much symmetry, does this mean that the S matrix can be written just purely in terms of symmetry generators of some algebra. And this normally is the case for the Jungian. So mathematicians have worked out the universal R matrix in many, many cases. Once you have the universal R matrix, then you have powerful theorems. For example, a theorem by Drinfeld, which says that if you have this abstract solution, and moreover it satisfies what is called quasi-triangularity, which is some sort of representation-independent version of the bootstrap, and it's this thing, then it also satisfies Jahn-Baxter equation and crossing. So you have a way of directly proving the properties of the S matrix in a purely algebraic way. And you can think that the complete solution of the scattering problem reduces to find this abstract tensor given the Opf algebra. And then, if you're interested in the S matrix on particular states, particular representation, you just project it into your favorite, for example, for us, bound state representation, and you get your S matrix. More than this, I find interesting that there are constructions, for example, this one by Leclerc and Smirnov, where you think of completely solving or constructing the model from the universal R matrix and the representation theory of the associated quantum group, which is interesting because it means that maybe we could answer Staudacher's question. What is ultimately the model that we are diagonalizing? Maybe we could answer this question using the representation theory of the Jungian, of the quantum group that we know underlies this S matrix. Of course, this is all nice, but it's very tough. So in standard mathematical treatments, what turned to be very useful is to study not completely, not directly this problem, but a little bit simplified version of the problem. So what would Drinfeld do, hypothetically? Let's study perturbation. Let's find a regime where we can perturb a little bit the R matrix around the identity. Suppose that we have this. Then it turned out in standard cases that one could actually classify the algebraic structure. Suppose that R starts with 1, and then there is an h bar, little r, and then it continues. And R, little r, of course, lives in the Lie algebra times itself, some sort of exponential map. And it's called the classical R matrix, and it satisfies a little bit simpler equation than the one satisfied by R, which is this, and which is the classical Jahn-Baxter equation, which is this one. And so let us see what are the standard treatments for the classical R matrix. And most importantly, the relevance of the classical R matrix was that the classical limit actually encodes the entire information on the quantum continuation. It's some sort of natural continuation from the classical to the quantum. The theorem that I've reported here by Belavin and Drinfeld says that under certain conditions, which part of which I've spelled here, there is a huge gap here that one I can give, but it's of course in the literature. Under certain assumption, the classical R matrix is basically completely determined by its pole structure. In particular, it has simple poles that form a lattice in the plane U, where U is the difference of these spectral parameters. They assumed that R depended only on the difference, and they classified. And the case which is relevant to us is when this lattice is just one point in the origin, and this is the case of rational R matrix, namely Jungians. Now, let me give you a flavor how this works, why the classical R matrix has the power of generating the quantum structure, or at least giving the seed of it. It's very nice to see this in terms of factorization. And The classical example is Young's example, the prototype of a classical R matrix, solution of classical Young-Baxter equation. It's the Casimir divided by this pole, and you see that if you use the geometric series, then you can re-express it in terms of some generators that you read from here. Of course, you have to put one in the first and two in the second. That's why you need the geometric series. And they satisfy this. So from the simple form of the classical R matrix, you see a loop algebra, which is, of course, a classical Youngian, which, when you deform, will become a Youngian. But you already see, from this simple procedure, how an algebra emerges from the classical R matrix, just to give the flavor how relevant the classical R matrix is. Okay, there is also another theorem, and this I've just said. So what about the ADS-CFT? Well, there is such a regime where R becomes 1 plus H bar R plus something in the near VMN, where H bar is actually this parameter 1 over G related to the Toft coupling. And R, this little R, has been computed on the string worksheet by this very same gentleman of before. And in the classical limit, it turns useful this representation of the x plus minus variables in terms of this x, because they just become x in the g to infinity limit, an unconstrained variable in this representation. So let's see what the classical limit entails. So the algebra itself moves with the classical limit because the labels depend on g, and it tends to a limited centrally extended PSU2/2. Of course, we cannot apply Belavin-Drinfeld because it's not even of difference form, let alone that it's not simple, the algebra. But nevertheless, let's try to get inspiration from this result. It has a simple pole at the origin when these two parameters are equal, and the dimension of this lattice, which was relevant in Belavin-Drinfeld, is 0. So this at least suggests a Youngian. But here we find a tricky point. There is an easy theorem that one could prove that in order to satisfy the classical Young-Baxter equation with such a pole, the residue must be a Casimir. But for centrally extended PSU2/2, you don't really know how to construct this, because, again, the Killing form is degenerate. So how do you get away with this? And the result, the answer, is that the residue at the origin is actually the quadratic Casimir of another algebra, which is GL2/2, which has a non-degenerate form. So it seems, funny enough, that just on the pole, the algebra borrows an extra generator which is outside PSU2/2, because it's not super-traceless, from the closest non-degenerate superalgebra, just to respect the theorem. And away from the residue, the symmetry is, of course, broken. So, and then, okay, only on the pole, then you can go to difference forms, so you reduce to some standard structure. So what's going on? Nearest is just my fancy name. You extend just by one. You don't go very far to put many other generators. You just need one extra Cartan generator to make it non-degenerate. Yeah, it has one more. And this you need. On the residue, you find this. There is this extra generator just on the pole. And indeed, this is a very well-known prescription in mathematics for R matrices that are based on such algebras which have degenerate Cartan matrices by Koroshkin and Tolstoy. How does it work? They constructed with the quantum double the universal R matrix for a very large class of algebras, and it always goes like this. There are products on roots on both sides, and here you see there is a part which depends on these Cartan generators, the diagonal ones, but there is the inverse of the Cartan matrix. And what they tell you is that if you don't have it, then extend a little bit until you can invert the Cartan matrix. Add Cartan generators. So it is expected that we had to call sooner or later an extra generators if we believe that one day we'll be able to write something like this. So it was an expectation that an extra generators was there, and we found it on the residue. So we may have a chance of factorizing this S matrix, this R matrix. And okay, the GL22 actually appeared also in another regime, but let me skip on that. So how do we try to factorize that? Remember how we did in Young's case, there was the Casimir divided by the pole, and we did this, and we arrived, we read off some generators just by doing this. So there is a way that we did with the classical R matrix of ADS-CFT, expanding these poles. Of course, it's much more complicated than this one, but now this way is sort of obsolete. The only reason why I reported here is that, again, you see that once you try to do this, then you have to call in the game this B, which is a generator of this type. Again, if you want to factorize the R matrix, you see the emergence of the extra of this extra generator with this signature. This is the representation that you need, that we needed at the time. And the bonus of this proposal was that this guy vanishes for n equals 0. And indeed, we know that there is no such symmetry at the Lie algebra level. Only can be only at the Jungian level. So this was a nice property. But what this suggests is that for higher Jungian level, you might have this kind of symmetries also in the quantum R matrix. So in other words, is this type of symmetry a symmetry in any possible sense of the quantum R matrix? And it's, of course, the answer is, of course, yes. And here it is. So there is a symmetry, which is a Jungian one, of the full quantum S matrix. Don't be misled by this 1 over G. This is an exact symmetry with this coproduct, this antipode, and this representation. This is a quantum symmetry. And now, if you play the game and you use it to commute with the old one that Bizard found, you generate new type of supercharges that may or may not be related to the old one. And here I want to introduce the fact that there is now a new proposal by Bizard and Spiel for the factorization of the classical R matrix, which has nicer properties. But still, you need this extra generator B. In their language, this is the one that they need. And this form is the one that has been confirmed for higher bound state representation when you take the limit of the complete S matrix. Of course, in this proposal, there are interesting questions, like in this case, this B appears already at the Lie algebra level, so but we know that it's not a symmetry. So, but I don't know if this is a contradiction or not, if it does have to be a symmetry in order to appear here. And then it would be very nice to make connection with what comes from the string worksheet, other studies of the classical R matrix. How are these related to these proposals? But at least we know that there is an extra symmetry that was hidden or secret inside the S matrix. So now let me come back quickly to this stubborn boy, which is the difference form. Okay, this B hat, additional generators, also goes like U to the power N. So this is some sort of evaluation representation. In Bizard-Spiel proposal, we have pretty 1 over U1 minus U2s. Kind of structures in nice places. Then we prove that there exists what is called the Drimfeld's second realization of this Jungian in one evaluation representation, which is still of this type. Some parameter shift by some quantity, which depends on the representation, but still to the power n. So it looks like, again, it continues to go like u to the power n. So where is this difference form? there are connections with the exceptional algebra where you would expect, again, like this. So it looks like the Jungian is calling for a difference form, but on the other hand, the representation itself depends on you. That's why you don't see it in the S matrix. The S matrix, she would want to depend on U1 minus U2, but A, B, C, D, the parameters of the representation itself depend on you, so everything is screwed up. You don't have this nice dependence. But the message is that if you one day find the universal R matrix, this should immediately disentangle, because the universal R matrix distinguishes very well between what's spectral parameter, what's representation. And in principle, it doesn't even know anything about the representation. So that's why I came up with this provocative rewriting, where I tried to rewrite Beisert's S matrix in terms of difference forms and recognizable combination of the representation labels that look to me like this Koroshkin-Tolstoy. But let me move now to what the future has told, which is the bound state S matrix. How much time? 14. Okay, so the bound state S matrix. Why are we interested in this? First of all, bound state, we know that the fundamental S matrix has a pole, and to this pole corresponds a bound state, and actually the asymptotic spectrum is not just the fundamental particle, but a tower of bound states. So you're interested in principle in computing this, and of course there is a more mathematical dream that I hope I justified a little bit to you, which is to figure out the universal R matrix. Once you know it in as many representations as possible, you might just guess at the end what it is, this universal form. But more concretely, we are interested in finite size correction. And as I understand, integrability dictates that you should look for the complete set of asymptotic data, including all scattering matrices, to then process this information towards finite size. So it looks like a nice plan to compute all this. And moreover, so far, there are beautiful constructions, which, again, I understand partially are based on conjectures. So it would be nice to approach, through an alternative route, this program and just construct the S matrix for arbitrary bound state. So let us follow this direct S matrix approach and see how far we can go. So the explicit construction goes like this. We use the superspace formalism of this paper, which works for this atypical, totally symmetric representation, which are the ones of the bound state. You have these superfields, which depend on variables W, and so two bosonic variables W and two theta variables. And this, so an analytic function in those is expanded like this, and then you can further expand this way, and this furnishes a representation for the bound state with bound state number L. And here is how you realize the symmetry algebra in this formalism. These labels here I just reported, and the x plus x minus variables that also appeared before satisfy this constraint. And this integer L, as I said, is the number of bound state constituents. So you have a very nice formalism, let me just go back, in which you just add a component to the bound state by adding variables to these polynomials. You construct them in a very efficient way. Okay, how does the S matrix look like? Because of this SU2 cross SU2 invariance, which is undeformed, which has a trivial coproduct, in this frame, the S matrix is automatically block diagonal. So you can factorize. There are closest set of states that transform under itself into itself under the action of the S matrix. So let me give these three cases. There is case one, and you'll see how easy it is to classify. It comes in two types, A and B. And there are two times. L1 is the bound state in the first space of the S matrix, L2, the bound state number in the second one. Let me call this vector space V1. And A and B stands for alpha equal 3 or 4. These are the states in this case. You have a fermion of type alpha, and then bosons, as much as you want, and then same type of fermion, bosons as much as you want. And it comes into flavor, of course, alpha 3 and 4. So these are the state. The labels K and L run over the obvious ranges, not to make these negatives. So it's very easy to count. This is closed. Then there is case 2, again in 2 flavors, and this is how many states we have. Again, A and B for alpha 3 and 4, and these are the states that you can have, fermionic states. So you have a fermion here, or in the second space, theta alpha, theta 3, theta 4. This is all you can construct. And again, K and L run over the obvious ranges. And finally, you have case 3, which just comes in one flavor, and it's this. You have, of course, all these states. Okay, so the S matrix, because of this SU2 cross SU2 invariance, is of block diagonal form. The outer blocks, you remember, they scatter this case 1, which was coming into flavors. So, again, that's why there are 2 blocks like this. This Y's scatter case 2, and this big central block Z scatters this K3 states. And then, to compute the full S matrix, in this representation, you need to take 2 copies of it and times the square of this phase factor, where here's the dressing phase, and here are these kinematical factors. And this is the variable U. Okay. So all these cases are related if you use these co-products of the symmetry generators and their Jungian partners. So you can go all along the lines of these diagrams using this symmetry. And this will be very useful because if you are able to compute the S matrix exactly in one of these, then you can just use the symmetry to move and to argue and explicitly compute what the S matrix is on the other one, following this arrow. So let's see how this works. And case 1, you remember, it was just one single line. It looks easier, so it looks like we can actually solve that one. So how do we solve it? First, let me define a vacuum state, which is morally a highest waste state, but we know it's not. But anyway, it belongs to this case 3. Is this all bosons of type 1, say. This fixes the normalization. We work in the normalization when our matrix on this state is, again, this state. And then we use this relation. We can generate this particular state of case 1 out of this vacuum by acting on this with this symmetry generators and then normalizing in a certain way. In other words, we can go from the vacuum which sits here 2 times with some delta of supercharges and we end up here or here, depends on the indices. And we generate it. We generate this state which is 0, 0 in this notation. 0, 0. It doesn't have W2s. Okay, so from this formula, we can just compute, because now the philosophy is that R, when acting on this, just goes through the deltas and makes them delta ops. Then it hits 0, and we know that it's just 1. And then this acts again on 0 and gives some coefficient times this state again. And this is explicitly calculable, and it's this function D. So we know how the R matrix acts on this 0, 0. And then we do the same to generate the entire case 1 from 0, 0. Because now we need the Jungians, we observe that we can describe the state KL, arbitrary state KL in this case 1, by an action of this, by a combined action of these generators on this 0, 0. And then again, when you have something like this and you act with R, R goes through, makes this delta ops, and then it's something where you know what R is doing, just D. And then you act with this. With what you're left with is delta op acting with this. You just compute it, and this is what you get. The action of R on the case one state, of course, decomposes in this way. This is just because you get all these states with arbitrary n. So this is a number of W2s in the first space, W2s in the second space, and this is the expression. It looks a bit heavy, but it's completely explicit. Moreover, it's the restriction of an hypergeometric function to integer labels. And moreover, you observe that you're in a lucky situation. This hypergeometric is balanced, which means this, but most importantly, it means that it's a 6J symbol, according to this formula. So the amplitude on this state is just a 6J symbol. And the relevant 6J symbol, if you plug in these numbers with these, it's just given by this. So, okay, you found some exact answer. It shows the correct pole structure that you would expect. And moreover, these states of case one are really highest weight with respect to a fermionic SU2, and they are transformed, as you may understand, since only W1s and W2s transform, by the bosonic SU2. So they carry a representation of the bosonic SU2. So it is a 6J symbol, which means that this block, and moreover, this 6J symbol actually have half integer coefficients on the poles, so it really have standard fusion. It's of difference form, so maybe it's just the representation of the universal R matrix of the Youngian of this bosonic SU2 in arbitrary evaluation representation. Is this so? Yes, otherwise I wouldn't be asking. It is, so what we have found is that that 6J symbol, which was actually known, is the representation of the universal R matrix of SU2 on arbitrary bound state, times a D. D is this scalar factor. And since, as we will see, from the case one, we generate all the rest, this makes us hope that this universal piece is actually a block of the would be universal R matrix. It might be that a genuine factor of the full universal R matrix is just Koroshkin-Tolstoy universal R matrix for the Youngian. And then you construct the S matrix from this case one using those arrows. You do it for all the other states. Here I've described how you could do it. I think I don't have time, but I just want to say that if you do this construction, you automatically get the R matrix in a form which is very nice from the Hopf algebra point of view. You automatically get it in a factorized form. So we obtain this, what is called factorizing twist. So with this procedure, which is actually very easy, but I don't have time to go through it, you automatically get it this way. Okay. For those who want to read, I reported the full therapy for case two. I skip the therapy, and I go to the remarks. Okay, let me just show. For example, for case two, we can give it again in explicit matrix form. These are all variables that are perfectly defined, and we can do the same for case three. And moreover, the S matrix is uniquely determined by this procedure. A remark, which is again on the same footing as other remarks I've been making, this results again depend only on the difference of the spectral parameters delta U, as the Youngians calls for it, and these variables, which are these combinations here. They always come in this combination, which from the Hopf algebra point of view are kind of expected. The rest is taken care of by combinatorial factors. So this doesn't mean that finding the universal R matrix will be easy, but you never know. Then, of course, if you reduce to a limit of small bound state number in one of the two leg, we reproduce a known result, known S matrices that were actually computed. And what we did last Friday is now you can take this S matrix and compute the transfer matrix where the legs are in arbitrary representation. And then by restricting, and then you can use the algebraic Bethe-Ansatz to find the eigenvalue, and we reproduce the conjectures by Beisert in this paper for the quantum characteristic function. So let me conclude. A deep mathematical structure seems to be there, but we have... So in some sense, what I try to convey is that it looks very similar to standard cases, but you cannot stretch the analogy too much because it's also much harder. So it's this funny situation. Nevertheless, a blooming of developments allowed us to, and allowed to unveil many of the most useful bits of it to start computing. More progress is expected. Of course, one would like to understand better the role of this secret symmetry and construct a full quantum double derivation and maybe one day the universal R matrix. And let me end with fascinating connections with Jungian and dual superconformer symmetries that are arising in a totally, apparently, different sector of super-Young Mills, the scattering amplitudes, and they wait to be investigated, and I'm really looking forward to Jan's talk on Thursday. Thank you.
Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
Okay, from the mathematical point of view, evaluation representation is a representation that has u to the power n times rho, where rho is a representation of the Lie algebra, Lie subalgebra, which sits in the Jungian. For us, yeah, this means that it's just u to the n times this qa. Right, yeah, it's been the same, yeah, because that's a specific representation.
Anything else? No, doesn't seem to be the case. Then let's move on to the next speaker. Thank you.